Much to my dad's dismay, my mom gave the soldiers a defiant international gesture for kiss my ass. But we made it across safely. Sarah and I assumed all of this was quite normal. Back home in Ann Arbor, we traveled just as widely in our minds, reading book after book about explorers, pioneers, and inventors who helped make history and change the world. In our basement, Sarah and I transformed an old refrigerator box into a spaceship, where we spent many happy hours exploring strange planets and faraway galaxies. I even sacrificed a few corks, the kind with plastic tops, for the cause. Inserted through the cardboard walls of our spacecraft, they made excellent knobs for adjusting the booster rockets. When I was 11, we moved to England for a year for one of my dad's sabbaticals. We lived in Durham, a small northern cathedral town, in a 400-year-old gatekeeper's cottage overlooking the River Weir. Every morning, Sarah and I would put on our school uniforms and trudge off to the Durham-Johnston Grammar Technical School, a gray Dickensian institution where teachers, or masters as they were called, required us to stand at attention whenever they entered the room and complete our lessons with fountain pens. But if the stern traditionalists at Durham-Johnston were inclined to view Sarah and me as wayward latter-day colonials, we took it upon ourselves to excel to such a degree that there would be little doubt that the Yanks, as we were known, had not only won the revolution, but were first in their class, too. And then, in a few horrible moments, my whole life changed. Leaving England, we took a family trip to India. After sharing a fun week aboard a houseboat on a gorgeous lake in Kashmir, my parents hired guides to take us all pony trekking up into the Himalayas. Crossing a swollen river, Sarah's pony slipped on a rock and threw her into the rushing waters. My dad and two of our guides sprinted in to save her, but the thundering rapids and boulders overwhelmed them. Sarah, along with one of the men who tried to save her, hit the rocks and was swept away. We searched the river for 2 days as we hiked out, but never found them. She was 14. I was devastated beyond comprehension. Sarah had been my best friend, and in a single, terrible fluke, just a few yards from safety, she had been taken from me forever. Gone were the games, the laughter, the mischievous conspiracies of our childhood. And gone were any illusions that the world was safe, that parents were all-powerful, or that life was fun. I still might have been a kid, but my childhood was over. Already a close family, we pulled together even more. Still, the years of adolescence that followed were an exercise in abject misery, and I struggled through by channeling my grief into a frenetic schedule of study, sports, and music lessons. One of the few bright spots in junior high was building a raft with my best friend, Andrew, out of 126 cardboard milk cartons and several rolls of duct tape. About 10 feet long, the boat featured a sweeping prow that resembled a Viking ship, complete with a dragon's head whose pointed horns were half-pint cartons, emptied of their half and half. We called our vessel the SS Milky Way and launched it in the Huron River to a smattering of applause from friends and family. It floated beautifully, and we gave rides all afternoon before bringing it back to Andrew's house. Unfortunately, only a day or so later, our craft began assuming the look and smell of blue cheese. Only reluctantly, and at the strong insistence of Andrew's dad, did we haul it to the curb for the garbage man. Some years later, after high school, I took a summer job as a hotel groundskeeper on Mackinac Island, a small historic resort in Michigan's Straits of Mackinac, at the confluence of Lakes Michigan and Huron. I loved all the boats that jammed its harbor and went there hoping to spend time on the water. Seeing I was young and fit, the head groundskeeper assigned me the task of moving rocks, work that made the prospect of 2 months on Mackinac seem more like a sentence on Alcatraz. After 2 days at hard labor, I hatched a plan. I had brought along my violin and convinced the resort's owner to give me a tryout as a violinist in his restaurant. "I've played the violin since I was 4," I said, concealing my nervousness. "I can do more for you making music than I can moving rocks." Something of a wheeler-dealer himself, he admired my chutzpah. He also liked the idea of replacing his maitre d's George Winson tapes with some live entertainment. So, for the next few days, I moved rocks by day and played violin by night. Then, when I complained that my hands could only manage one or the other, the owner shifted me to musical work altogether, and I traded my grubby jeans for a black suit, bow tie, and the easy life of a solo strolling violinist. The head groundskeeper grumbled at my escape from his rock pile, but I didn't care. My quarry had now become all those romantic couples who tipped so generously for a few songs at tableside. When I was done for the night, I'd walk home and pull the crumpled bills from my pockets, along with that night's haul of corks. Not that I had plans to build the boat of my dreams any time soon, but saving those corks reminded me, somehow, of happier times. By summer's end, when I shipped off the island, I had several hundred. The next summer, after my freshman year at Stanford, I returned to Mackinac in style, bringing my family's sailboat, a 13-foot dinghy called the Cyclone. Rather than spend all my tip money on one of the expensive slips at the marina, I chained two cement-filled buckets together, dropped them in the middle of the harbor, and ran a heavy rope all the way up to a grease jug float on the surface. This economical mooring enabled me to keep the Cyclone safely out in the harbor, bobbing amid yachts 4 and 5 times its size. The only drawback to this location was that I had to swim out and back every time I wanted to go for a sail, an invigoratingly cold prospect, even in August. Sometimes, if a friend was willing to swim for the mooring, I would sail us both over to Round Island, just across the channel. Round Island was an uninhabited, forested state park with a sandy cove, a crumbling lighthouse, and, during the hot days of July, sweet wild raspberries growing near the beach. Even amid the swirling angst of those late adolescent years, the afternoons I spent on Round Island were the epitome of carefree summertime bliss. I swam, sunned, and ate berries until my fingers ran red, just, I imagined, like Huck Finn. At college out in Palo Alto, between academics and work at the Stanford Daily, I taught sailing and built another boat. I entered it in a campus regatta requiring that all vessels be built of cardboard. Mine, resembling a crocodile, took second place. After graduating, I spent 10 years bumping between political campaigns and journalism, including a 3-year stint in Spain as a freelance foreign correspondent. I even tried my hand at bullfighting once, in a village near Madrid, and lost. So bruised and bloodied in this foolish, self-imposed test of manhood, I escaped serious injury and ended up selling a first-person account to the Los Angeles Times for $500, enough to pay a month's rent. But no matter where I lived or what I was doing throughout that decade after college, I could never quite shake the nagging worry that somehow, for some reason, the well of adventure would dry up, and that my life would suddenly become boring. So I stretched out my peregrinations year after year, determined to postpone traditional responsibilities and the trappings of adulthood as long as possible. At the age of 33, however, I finally had to concede that I was, without a doubt, an adult. I lived in Washington, D.C., and wore a suit and tie to work. I had a retirement account. I even carried life insurance. But despite all that, I was still saving corks for the boat. I wasn't any closer to building it, really, but I hadn't given up on the idea. Even as an adult, in fact, especially as an adult, the notion of building a cork boat was just too playful, too whimsical to drop. And in my workaday world on Capitol Hill, play and whimsy were in decidedly short supply. I worked as a speechwriter for Congressman David Bonier of Michigan, the Democratic whip in the U.S. House of Representatives. From a professional standpoint, my job was a good one. I shared Bonier's political values, and as his speechwriter, I had an office in the Capitol, free run of the House floor, and an inside, albeit minor, role in shaping the national political debate. From a personal standpoint, however, the rancorous rhetorical battles with Newt Gingrich and his GOP partisans began to take their toll on me. It often seemed that we were fighting over the same stretch of muddy ground, issue after issue, vote after vote, month after month, year after year. While some of my fellow staffers relished the fight, these endless conflicts came to remind me of trench warfare in the First World War, costly, bloody, and ultimately futile. This political stalemate found its ultimate expression in the 1998 impeachment of President Clinton. As the Congress set aside virtually all other business to investigate and prosecute presidential blowjobs, Washington, at its best only a Gomorrah of hope, sank even further into the quagmire of hubris and hypocrisy. Penning floor speeches for Bonier, I was in the thick of the fight. Not to defend President Clinton's opaque, self-destructive evasions about Monica Lewinsky, but to prevent the Republicans, frustrated in their legislative ambitions, from treating the Constitution like so much political toilet paper. This epic political battle was at once fascinating, exciting, demoralizing, and exhausting. On the morning of the House impeachment vote, I took a few moments to relax at my desk, as much as that was possible with the Capitol a zoo, hundreds of protesters yelling outside my window, and a president of the United States about to be put on trial for the second time in history. By then, Bonnier's speech was written and ready for delivery. I had stayed up late writing, and we had made the final edits together in the morning. Suddenly, the door to my office flew open, and Bonnier's press secretary shouted, "Livingston is resigning." I grabbed the remote and upped the volume on my TV. Bob Livingston was the Republican speaker-elect, and his decision was a stunning development, even on this most surreal of days. Having already admitted to numerous affairs only 36 hours earlier, Livingston was now apparently making the best of an awkward situation. While passing up the chance to lead the House as Speaker, he said he would continue to serve Congress for another 6 months as a backbencher, giving the governor of his state time to call a special election, and, coincidentally, giving any GOP nominee ample time to mount a strong campaign. Now, on the House floor, he was calling on President Clinton to resign as well, immediately. The catcall ceased as Democrats and Republicans alike, momentarily stunned, watched drop-jawed at the unfolding drama. My immediate reaction, by contrast, was a loud four-letter expletive that also happened to describe, albeit unintentionally, Livingston's favorite extramarital activity. Even as Livingston spoke, my phone lit up with calls. I didn't answer. Instead, I grabbed my suit jacket and began pushing my way through the crowded hallways toward the House floor. I had to find Bonnier. He was scheduled to speak in about 15 minutes, and his speech needed a rewrite. Every writing deadline I had ever faced, in school or journalism or politics, paled in comparison to this one, not just in its crushing immediacy, but in its consequence. As I rushed into and then out of an emergency meeting with Bonnier, Minority Leader Dick Gephardt, and a handful of grim-faced staffers, I thought to myself, now is not the time to choke. Now is the time to stand and deliver. And so, with Bonnier's communications director standing over my shoulder and the clock ticking, I sat down at my keyboard to write a new beginning. Within 10 minutes, I was standing with other staffers at the back of the packed House floor as Bonnier, standing at an oak lectern, responded to Livingston's resignation. We find ourselves in a destructive cycle that is eating away at our democracy. The politics of personal smear is degrading the dignity of public office, and we must not let it continue. We must put an end to it, and the only way we will stop this vicious cycle is if we stand up and refuse to give in to it, whether it's Bill Clinton or Bob Livingston. My heart was pounding, but the chamber was wrapped. Then, as Bonnier's speech began entering the more familiar territory of polished text, I exhaled in quiet relief. When Bonnier finished, the applause was deafening, at least from the Democratic side of the aisle. Not that it changed the course of history. Later that day, the GOP succeeded in impeaching Clinton on 2 counts. What did change that day, though, was my faith in the state of our democracy. It was going to hell, and faster than I had ever imagined. It's not that I had arrived in Washington naive. When I was in high school, my mom had run for the Michigan State Senate and won, the first woman elected to that body in more than a decade. In the years that followed, we talked hardball politics over dinner as if it were the weather. Throughout the course of my 20s, I had worked on too many campaigns, local and statewide, to have any optimistic illusions about the corrupt and ailing condition of America's electoral system. In 1994, my mom's narrow defeat in her underdog bid for the U.S. Senate had hammered home to me the harsh realities of modern American politics, the limits of grassroots idealism, and the overwhelming power of big money. But I had soldiered on because politics still mattered, because I thought I could make a difference, and because we Pollocks weren't supposed to quit. But now, working in Congress was putting me to the test. It wasn't just the whole impeachment saga, the holier-than-thou hypocrisy of philanderers on both sides of the aisle, or the lynch mob mentality that fueled it. It was really more the day-to-day pettiness of Congress and so many of its members. Although I respected Bonnier and admired another handful of principled, down-to-earth legislators, they were a distinct minority in these halls. There were so many more, though, Democrats and Republicans alike, who were the very definition of mediocrity, yet they had come to believe their own press releases. Although it is common habit in Washington to speak on behalf of the American people, too many elected representatives treated those American people nearest at hand, congressional staffers, like serfs in Tsarist Russia. The worst offenders were usually those middling members who, frustrated by their inability to move up in the House leadership, had reached the apex of a political career that had probably begun with a fourth-grade run Student Council.